Hey guys, and welcome back to episode 9 of Underrated, a podcast where we look at films we believe are underrated, generally disliked, or simply forgotten. I'm your host, Gabriel Green, and today we are traveling to the furthest reaches of the cosmos. But I will not be going alone. With me is my faithful co-host and companion, James Hamrick. How you doing, man?
I'm doing pretty good. This has been test week, so I've been studying for like 48 hours straight, it seems. So this is going to be a nice little reprieve from that.
How's that going?
It's going well. I have one last test tomorrow, so as soon as this is over, I'm heading to the library.
Okay. So today we will be reviewing Christopher Nolan's Interstellar. But before we get into that, I'd like to ask you, if you enjoy the show, could you please take a minute to subscribe and rate and review us on iTunes? Just subscriptions and reviews help people find us on iTunes and really get the word out online. And that would just help us a lot, and we'd really appreciate it. Yeah, and stay tuned to the end. We'll be announcing something special for our 10th episode next week. But before we get into the main topic, have you seen any cool movies recently, James?
I wasn't able to go out and see Magnificent Seven, but the only movie I've seen since we last recorded was The Conjuring. I'd already seen it before, but I watched it again with some friends now that it's October, and we're trying to start watching maybe a couple scary movies a week. So that was the first one on our little marathon. And to me, The Conjuring, along with like the Insidious movies, are some of the best modern horror movies out there. And I think it's because James Wan, like the only other horror movie directors who I can think of that are still working that come close would be someone like Scott Derrickson, who's actually going to be directing Doctor Strange. But James Wan, like, what he can do so well that few other directors I feel like do is actually make you care about the characters in the movie. And he does a really good job of establishing them before the movie really gets going. And then he can build tension in ways that others really can't. They're just kind of like, now it's dark and the music plays up and here's the jump scare. Like, it's a really lazy way of building tension in a lot of other movies, but here he sets up scares in a way that's really, I think, really well done, where he'll have somebody play the piano and you hear that it makes actually certain kind of notes when it's played, and that's to set up like the fact that much later on in the movie, all of a sudden you hear those same kind of notes, and so it wasn't just, oh, there's a creepy piano being played. It makes sense within the context, and you kind of be like, oh, that's a callback to what we saw earlier. He just does a really good job all throughout all of his movies.
Interesting. Yeah, I haven't seen that movie, and I probably don't plan to because I'm a wimp and I can't do horror. But I did enjoy his Fast 7, or Furious 7. I think it's Furious 7. It's stupid as anything, but it's a lot of fun. So I'm interested to see what he'll do with Aquaman.
Yeah, that's really interesting. He definitely isn't the first director I would have picked for that, but I can't really complain about it because I loved everything I've seen from him so far. And I'm really curious as to what it was about him that the studio saw that they're like, this is the guy that we need to get to do Aquaman. So I'm excited.
All right. I saw Deepwater Horizon from director Peter Berg and starring Mark Wahlberg and Kurt Russell. And it is fantastic. It might just be like one of the best disaster movies I've ever seen. It tells the story of the 2010 disaster on the oil rig Deepwater Horizon. It exploded and caused a huge oil spill. And what makes this film work really well is how Berg sets up these characters. I mean, he doesn't devote all that much time to it, but it's very effectively done, and we care about like Mark Wahlberg and Kurt Russell and Gina Rodriguez. She's also very good. But then once the film actually gets going, it does a really great job of breaking down everything that went wrong, like step by step. And there's a lot of like really dense techno babble going on, but with the mix of just showing us the inside of the pipes as things are breaking down, or just clever word pictures, Berg shows us everything that's going on, so we never feel confused, even though it's very complex actually. And it actually feels very real to life, of like how these guys, these very blue collar workers, work in these situations. They feel very human. There's a like great banter and rapport between them. And then once the disaster strikes, it is intense. The sound design, like for every explosion, you're cringing because you like you can literally hear the shrapnel whistling by every time. And these people are like stuck in the middle of with explosions going off and things collapsing. And it feels like you're there. It's one of the most intense films I've ever seen. I was like, your insides are like tied in a knot for the entire last half of this film. And it's not like it plays it like Roland Emmerich would just play it for laughs or cheap thrills. It actually, it makes you feel for these people. You care about these people. You're scared for these people who are stuck in there. It's just a really very human and very intense, I don't know if I would call it an action film, but it's very much a thriller.
Are you saying it's better than Armageddon?
I haven't seen Armageddon, but based on the pedigree, I would say yes, probably.
All right, I'll have to check it out, I guess, then.
You really should. I think it's very likely to be in my top 10 this year.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm really starting to like Peter Berg. He's had some misses like Hancock and Battleship, but I mean, I think Battleship is a bit of a guilty pleasure for me, but it is horrible. But films like The Rundown or The Kingdom or Lone Survivor, and now this one, they're all really good.
Oh, I didn't know he did Lone Survivor. I really, really like that one.
Yeah, yeah. He does a great job telling real-life scenarios, and he's actually got another Mark Wahlberg film coming out this year, I believe, about the Patriots Day bombing at the Boston Marathon. And I'm very interested in that, just because of the pedigree. And I also saw Miss Peregrine's Home for Peculiar Children. That was directed by Tim Burton. I really enjoyed the book, and I was looking forward to this. But it is directed by Tim Burton. And it actually starts off very strong. I really enjoy the first two acts. I think he does a really good job of setting up the world and also balancing the tone of it's kind of whimsical, but then there's this very creepy underlying vibe in there. But then once it actually should start getting scary, like when the climax comes around, the villains start showing up, it falls completely flat on its face. It's Tim Burton. He's just very erratic as a director. He doesn't know when to cut a scene, when a scene should be funny or should be scary. He doesn't know how to balance a tone. And so the entire third act, which should be dark and creepy, is like incredibly goofy. The villains, which are, from a design standpoint, are terrifying, and in the book are like horrific, are just plain laughable in the film. Samuel Jackson is awful. I mean, I never thought I would say this, but I don't blame him. I blame Tim Burton and the direction he was given. But he takes these characters that should be scary and creepy and makes them just laughable. And it's just embarrassing. And Tim Burton is also a very, very bad action director. And the third act climax has two very large action scenes, and they're horrible because they're like very slow. There's no energy. There's no sense of threat. And so it's like a character does this, and a character does this. And then they'll make these nonsensical choices. The villains will never actually hurt the main characters. They'll always just like knock them down and then walk away, even though they're supposed to be trying to kill them. And it's just really bad in the last act. So I was very disappointed with that.
Yeah, I've never really been a huge fan of Tim Burton. I get his appeal, because really, I mean, his movies are very distinctly him. I get why people like his art direction and his like production design, because it's very unique and it's different and it's out there. But yeah, just as a director, it just seems like, kind of like what you said, he doesn't really know where he's going with a lot of things. And I agree, like, he can't really direct action very well. Really, the only films of his that I really, really enjoy are Big Fish and Edward Scissorhands. That's because they're both, like, original stories. I especially dislike it when he takes on existing properties, because it's just so... It's not the way I imagined it. Mm-hmm. It's essentially just this world as pictured by Tim Burton, and then he can't really, the stories never flow well, I think, and I don't know, all of his characters feel very kind of contrived. I'm not sure. Like, there are things that I enjoy about almost every one of his movies, but just as a whole, kind of like what you said, there's too many negatives for me to really say I'm a big fan.
Yeah. I mean, he's not... I don't hate him. I actually quite enjoyed Frankenweenie, and I like Sweeney Todd, the demon barber of Fleet Street. It's too long of a name. But yeah, I enjoyed both of those. But the problem with Burton is he's undisciplined, and filmmaking is a craft. There are rules, and there are things, it's cause and effect. You have to do these, you have to build characters, you have to build tension, you have to build the worlds in order to, for the audience to buy into it. And he's just erratic when it comes to that. Sometimes it's good, sometimes it's bad. Like, you can like measure the pulse of his interest in directing. Like, each scene, some scenes he directs really well, other scenes are just like really boring. You could tell, oh, he cared about that scene, he couldn't care less about this scene, and you can feel it. And that is not how filmmaking works. It's not an overall terrible film. Asa Butterfield, I really like him as an actor, but I think he was poorly directed here, and his character isn't all that interesting. But I really, really liked Eva Green. She is really great as Miss Peregrine. And whoever plays Emma, I don't remember the girl's name, but she's also quite good. She's kind of the love interest for Asa Butterfield's character. So, I mean, I enjoyed the first two acts, but overall it was a major disappointment, because I really think the series had a lot of promise, and he just pretty much squandered it.
That's unfortunate.
Yeah. Is there anything else you wanted to talk about before we move into our main review?
Not really. I think I'm ready to start talking.
All right, let's move into our review of Interstellar. Interstellar was released in 2014. It was directed by Christopher Nolan on a budget of $165 million, and it grossed $675 million, which isn't too bad. It stars Matthew McConaughey, Anne Hathaway, Michael Caine, Jessica Chastain, John Lithgow, Matt Damon, surprise, and Casey Affleck and Topher Grace for some reason. I'm not sure why, but they're there. It's actually the first Nolan film not shot by cinematographer Wally Pfister. I believe he was working on his directorial debut, Transcendence, at the time. It's instead shot by Hoyt Van Hoytema. I'm sorry, I'm pretty sure I mispronounced that. And actually, he's coming back for Dunkirk, which is interesting, because Nolan has always worked with Wally Pfister before this.
Makes me wonder if Wally Pfister plans on continuing directing, and if that's why, or...
I don't know, because everybody hated Transcendence, basically, and it bombed pretty bad from what I heard.
Yeah, maybe that's just... Maybe he needs to stick with cinematography, because all of Nolan's films pre-Interstellar are just gorgeous, yeah. At least in the way they're shot.
Very much so. And, I put out a question on Facebook asking what people thought of the movie, and we got a couple of replies. Chad Hopkins said, "When I first saw this in theaters, I was absolutely engrossed for the entirety of the movie. I'm talking literal, edge of my seat. Until the last 20 minutes, the weird turn it takes was extremely jarring for the first time around, but I've warmed up to it a bit more on repeat viewings since I expect it now." And actually, that was very similar to my first viewing, minus the warming up to it part, which we'll talk about later. And Alexis Johnson simply said, "I love it." So this is your pick, James. What do you think about it?
It's honestly one of my favorite movies that he's done. I'm a big fan of like big epic sci-fi, but like in ways that doesn't even always have to be like, you know, Star Wars with space, but it's just like the exploration of it. To me, it kind of goes back to movies like 2001: A Space Odyssey and others, where it's not about aliens and things, it's just about space itself. Like, that's a character. And Nolan does such a good job with scope and scale that, like, bring those two together, like, it was bound to make a movie that I loved.
Yeah. I think ambitious is the, like, the best word to describe this film. I mean, it sounds cliche, but when you watch it, you'll understand it is truly ambitious. We will be spoiling this film, so if you have not seen it, please go watch it, then come back. So what are some of the things you liked about this movie?
Well, one of the first things that come to my mind is really came to my mind just when you were talking about the cast. Like, it is a star-studded cast. And I think even in little roles, like, I agree, like, Topher Grace showed up out of nowhere. I have no idea why they got him. I haven't even seen him in a movie for a while, since Spider-Man 3, for my memory. But I think everybody plays their characters so well. I feel like I could highlight the majority of the main cast and just talk about why I think that they were perfect for that part.
Yeah, they are all very good. And Matthew McConaughey, I mean, he's kind of, people kind of make jokes about him, but he's a legitimately great dramatic actor, and I think he plays it very well. And Anne Hathaway actually surprised me a lot this time around. I mean, I knew she was good in this, and I like her in The Dark Knight, but I kind of forgot how good she actually is in this role.
Yeah, it's weird, because Hathaway is actually not an actress that I typically enjoy that much. But when she was given this serious role, I think she did really well. I thought she was okay as Catwoman in Dark Knight Rises. She was, I mean, I have no reason to really complain about it. But in this, when she's actually given, like, some scenes to really show off her dramatic acting chops, I think she does really, really good.
Just one thing that really struck me right off the bat was how well Nolan portrays this just dying world. It's very believable. I mean, there's not a lot of obvious CGI, but we get these long, I don't know how he did it. Maybe he actually created a whole town and covered it in dust or something. But we see this world that's just, it looks and feels like it's dying. There's dust everywhere. People kind of walk around like with a mask on, and it just feels cold. And I think Nolan has always been really good at striking a tone just through visuals. And I really appreciated that.
Yeah. Whenever it first starts with the interviews with the people who were alive during it, and then instantly goes, like, right into the town, and you see it. It's a really good example to me of, like, showing instead of telling. Even though they do tell you, you buy it because of what you've seen beforehand. Yeah. And it's really, like, just this, it's such a bleak vibe. It's really a sad portrayal, but it's done so well where you really buy into it.
And I think the first act is both strong and weak, as in the world is set up very well. We get and understand the reason they have to go. We believe it and buy it. But I'll get into this more in my dislikes, but just some of the course of events just feel very awkward and unnatural. And that the main reason for that is the ending as well, but I'll get into that later. But just some of the first act felt kind of off for me, just in how he finds the base and all that. It just feels strange and out of place, I think.
Yeah, I think that because I was so, I became involved with these characters like pretty quickly. Yeah, I think my favorite thing about this movie is McConaughey and his relationship with Mackenzie Foy, who plays young Murph. The father-daughter dynamic is just so well done that as they were going through these events, I was just kind of, I felt more okay with the way it was going just because I really bought into this relationship early on. And some of it does kind of feel maybe a little awkward, especially in light of, because I have some problems with the ending as well. You know, early on, you think, well, okay, well, this is going to be better explained. And then when you find out that the explanation's a little iffy, then in retrospect, you're like, okay, well, I mean, it still kind of works, but maybe not as well as I was hoping.
Yeah, I think, I know I didn't have this problem first time around. I guess my issue with the first act this time was knowing the actual answers for it made it really frustrating. So, yeah, but I do think it is pretty well-paced, and it moves pretty quickly and effectively to get him into space. Before we get into space, I really liked John Lithgow in this movie. I haven't seen him in a lot, but he was really good as the kind of the patriarch figure of the family, and he had a really good rapport with McConaughey.
Yeah, I think he's an underused actor, and he was, to me, one of the best things about the Planet of the Apes reboot, Rise of the Planet of the Apes.
Yeah.
He's just very sympathetic character. And in this one, to me, I think the compliment I would give him is essentially to the entire family, and that's just that's what they felt like. It didn't really feel scripted. It felt like this was this kind of, you know, really middle of the nowhere town, and this family was just happened to be one of the families that lived there. Like, he had really good chemistry with McConaughey. They've got some really great lines with each other. But then he had good chemistry with the kids as well. It really felt like a family unit. And I know that, like, one of the things that Nolan is criticized for, even in some of his other films, is that he doesn't really get, like, characters well and emotion well. But for this movie, like, I didn't get that at all. I thought I was very emotionally invested with these characters. There's one scene involving Anne Hathaway's character that involves a lot of emotion that I'm not a big fan of. But for the most part, I think, like I said, again, with the relationship with the father and daughter being my favorite thing, the relationships between the entire cast, though, is really well done. And I think John Lithgow's an example of that.
Yeah, I've heard that quite a bit, too. People call Nolan cold, and I really could not disagree more about that, because, I mean, not just this film, in his Batman films, in Inception, I find his films very human and, like, just, like, bursting with this raw, powerful emotion very often. I don't understand that criticism at all. And I think the same applies here. I found it quite emotional, especially when he's getting ready to leave. And I thought that part worked quite well.
The scene where he is having to say goodbye to Murph, to me, that's almost, as sad as it is, it's one of my favorite scenes in the movie, just because it establishes why you're rooting for Cooper for the movie. Like, you know his motivations because of this relationship that he has. Like, there's a reason that he's trying to do this.
And then, I guess we might as well get into space now, but I have never seen such a compelling and just spellbinding portrait of space travel than is portrayed in this film. This is where the movie really shines and works. There were, like, three sequences in this film where I like, literally had to pick my jaw up off the floor just because of how beautiful and powerful these images that Nolan created were. The first one was when they first fly into the wormhole. Just how, I mean, it's so hard to explain. One interesting technique he used quite often was where it looks like he had a camera fixed to the outside of the spacecraft. He does it for a lot of the flying shots. But it really gives you a sense of, like, the speed and, like, scope of everything. Going through the wormhole and you see time and space are, like, bending around them. I mean, there's really no way to describe it vocally, but it's just completely beautiful.
Yeah, I think this movie has some of the most visually striking scenes of any movie that's come out recently. And yeah, the shots when he kind of fixes the camera on the outside, to me, what that highlights that I really liked about this movie is that Nolan knows how to perfectly blend CGI with practical effects. Because everything going on, like the wormhole bending, that's obviously all computer generated, but they do a really good job of making the spacecraft, like, look like it's a physical thing, and it's shaking around. It looks like it's a, you know, like when you look outside the window when you're flying in an airplane, you look at the wing, it's not perfectly still. It's kind of shaking around, and it looks like it's about to fall apart. That's almost what it felt like here, like this is this practical thing moving at this speed, and so it wasn't jarring at all. It felt like there was a sort of grounded realism to it, even whenever they were in these essentially fully computer-generated environments, like space.
And also, like, the sound design, like, whenever you go, it's always completely silent outside, because space has no sound. But then when you go inside the ship, you hear the creaking, you realize just how fragile this craft is. It kind of puts you on edge, because you know there's nothing outside. It's all just space. A tiny crack, they're all dead. You just feel like you're in space with these people.
Yeah, it's used so well to build the tension as you cut outside, and kind of just show the vastness of where they are, and then, like you said, you cut back in, and it sounds like it's about to fall apart from the inside. It really has you on the edge of your seat.
I think basically leaving Earth up until they land on the planet with Matt Damon on it, I think everything there is completely perfect from a cinematic perspective, because they've set up the threat on Earth. We know why they have to go on this mission. We know there's a ticking clock because plants are running out, which means less oxygen, which means everybody's going to die eventually. And so we have the ticking clock. Everything's counting down, and we know this is humanity's last hope. So that's a really good setup for the mission. And then we go planet after planet, and we see the problems and just them overcoming issues and whatnot. Like the water planet, that entire sequence is incredible. And then I talking about the water planet, the fact that this planet has waves the size of mountains would be crazy enough, but he adds the tension of every hour spent here is 7 years in the real world. And so the tension he's able to create out of thin air in that scene is incredible. You are literally gripping the edge of your seat because they got to get out of here, and the engines are stalling and the wave's coming. And then the shot when they finally get the engine started and when they're going up the front of the wave, it's like Nolan knows how to portray speed and just raw power very well. It's exciting.
I think it's made better just because of the practicality of the way he does everything. Like I said, he just tries to use CGI as little as possible. And in so many movies right now, sci-fi movies, and this almost plays out like a disaster movie in this scene. Whenever your eyes are being bombarded with so much on screen that you know is clearly not real, it's hard to really feel tense in those scenes. But because everything at this point has been so grounded, the stakes, even though they're maybe not higher than other movies, they feel that way just because it feels real. And it's like, oh, okay, now I'm concerned because, this doesn't just look like a bunch of nonsense on screen. And it also has one of my favorite transitions from a practical piece of set into CGI, which is when Tars is walking through the water and he has to turn around to go get Brand, Anne Hathaway's character. When he turns, there's it goes from a practical set piece to his CGI as his kind of arms and legs unfold and he starts rolling over there. And it's almost impossible to see where that happens. One of my least favorite things about CGI is that often whenever it comes into contact with actual physical sets or people, that's whenever you can tell that it's fake. But whenever he picks her up and he's wading through the water and he's splashing and he boards the ship, it all looks so real. And so there's never a moment where it even looks fake at all. You forget that you're watching something that couldn't have been done practically.
Yeah, I think there were only maybe two shots in this film where I actually thought, oh, that's CGI, just because it is so well done. Speaking of Tars, I mean, how awesome were those robots?
I think he's honestly one of the most underrated robots ever. I mean, I know everybody talks about R2-D2 and all these, and I love them, but Tars, to me, had some of the most, personality of any robot in a movie. And this movie had something that, another thing that Nolan is often criticized for, is a lack of humor. And to me, Tars had some of the best lines in the whole movie, especially early on as they were leaving. And I think a lot of, the lines themselves are really funny, but I think Bill Irwin, he's the actor who voices him, he just has a certain way of delivering these really dry lines in just a really humorous way. And so it kind of went on to he was essentially, an extra character, even though he didn't have a whole lot of screen time. His design, his physical design, as well as his character, and the fact that you could adjust different traits of his personality, I just think he was a great addition to the movie as a whole.
Yeah, just from a design standpoint, it's a really clever idea, just kind of a I don't even know how to describe it, like a Rubik's Cube almost that could walk. So it can like just adapt to any shape and any circumstance it needs it. And yeah, it's quite funny. I think his dialogue is very clever. As you said, Bill Irwin does a great job voicing it. I think the robots, they add a lot, they can be used for exposition very effectively because they are essentially computers. I think this film does a great job with the exposition overall of dumbing down these incredibly complex concepts for stupid people like us to understand. And I think overall it does a great job at that. Yeah, and speaking of the black hole, there's this one shot of when they're like descending towards the planet, the water planet, where they're like skimming just around the edge. Yeah, again, it's visual. And it's hard to explain it, but it is just like beautiful. Like there are moments in when I'm watching films that I kind of like refer to as like perfect, like cinematic perfection. And there are like multiple shots and moments and scenes in this film where I think are like literally perfect, kind of like personify what makes film great. And Nolan is such a fantastic filmmaker, and he does it quite a few times here, I think.
Yeah, there's a few shots that just, it's almost just worth like pausing and rewinding to watch it again because there's so much going on. I think the scene where they're on the ice planet that they find Matt Damon on, as they're flying through like under the, in that like the icy crevice almost, and it looks like it's kind of closing in, but it's just the perspective. There's so many shots like that where it's so well, and he holds it for a while just to like, so that you can kind of get a grasp on what's going on, but not for too long to where it gets like, okay, we get it. It looks cool. Like it's, you feel like you understand what's happening, but it's still something that you haven't seen before. It's really cool.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think just the overall production design of the spaceships and the suits and everything feels real. And you just feel like you're in space and that these are real, like lived in working pieces of equipment. And he actually supposedly he created like the largest spacecraft sets ever made to film this movie in. And the entirety of these spacecraft were actually built for him to film outside of, so he wouldn't have to do it in CG. It's really interesting.
Yeah, I usually don't really like it when people just complain a whole lot about CGI as if there's something inherently wrong with it, because I think there's just a lot of things in film that you need it there for. But I still appreciate what Nolan does, where he's saying, you know, for the sake of it just looking completely real, and that these actors are actually interacting with something that's there. Because I know a lot of movies, they'll do like fully CGI sets, and sometimes it works, but a lot of times it doesn't. And the spaceship sets in this almost gave me like a 70s kind of Alien feel to it.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is very kind of raw and practically designed. Everything, it's, you know, substance over style.
Yeah, I also don't think CGI is inherently bad. Like most films that use it are far more stylized and fantastical. This one is deliberately trying to be as realistic as possible, and I think like he definitely took the right approach in this case.
And just speaking of like just the practicality of the sets, one of my favorite scene, just in terms of like apart from the movie, just watching it as a scene, is the scene Matt Damon has already betrayed them, and he's flying up to the spacecraft, and he's trying to dock, and he doesn't have it targeted completely, and it opens up, and you just see like this explosion and debris fly everywhere, and they have to try to align the ship correctly. Everything looks real in that scene, especially like even like, you know, when they're zooming up on the ships as it's trying to align perfectly with the hatch. And because of all that, it made to me that one of the most pulse-pounding scenes I've seen in a movie. Everything about that scene, like from the cuts to the like to the characters' faces, and then back to what's going on to a wide shot, it all comes together. Like the CGI of the planet and space, back to the spaceships and the actors, is just so well put together.
Yeah, I think what helps is the sound design, where it's just the silence and emptiness of space feels like very much like a character in the moment as well. Like when the explosion happens, you see it from a distance, and you get just like the sinking feeling in your gut because you know this spaceship is the last hope for humanity. And as you see it being torn apart, and then they have to go after it and try to rescue it as it's falling into the atmosphere, it's a perfect sequence of tension. And I think what makes this film work as a whole is Hans Zimmer's score. I really cannot praise this score enough. Just how perfectly it kind of shepherds the tone of this film constantly throughout. It's, I guess, mainly organ-based, and it is just powerful. It's like the only word I can say to describe it. And I think like the main thing comes to a head in in the docking sequence. But I don't know. I'm not musically trained, so I really don't know the terminology for it all, but it is a very beautiful score, I think.
Yeah, I was actually about to bring up that was, to me, that was the thing that everything else about that scene worked, and what really just gave it that extra push to make it, to me, one of like this is the most well-crafted all around from every department to make it an amazing scene was the music. I think that this is probably my favorite Zimmer score. And I think probably, apart from the Middle Earth movies, this is actually my favorite soundtrack to any movie, because it does so many things. A lot of the time it's the exact same theme that's doing it. It's just played differently for whatever is happening on screen. Like in that scene, the music that we've heard that music before, but it's so much louder and it's so much faster this time, and so it makes it feel tense. But it's been used in like just scenes of space travel and very quiet scenes beforehand. And Hans Zimmer knows how to fit the mood perfectly. And on the special features, there's actually like a 40-minute featurette just over the music alone and what brought Zimmer to make all these different decisions that he did. And one of the reasons that he decided to go almost exclusively with the organ was because what he and Nolan were saying was that for the most part, like the organ is really kind of thought of with, you know, religion and church, you know, in a cathedral, and they associated it with just the idea of things bigger than us, like the just anything vast. And so they decided that since it's a movie about space, even though the organ isn't really the first thing your mind would go to, it fits the subject material. And to me, like, I can't think of another, I mean, like, I'm not musically literate either, and I'm not sure what brings these different composers to make the creative decisions that they do, but it just seems like such a weird choice initially, but it just works so well. And I think the other scene that it really helps highlight is the scene I was talking about earlier, wherever Cooper was having to leave Murph, and you hear the theme. There's a theme that he wrote specifically for Cooper and Murph, their relationship, and it's essentially just two notes that play. And then it kind of has background notes that'll begin to come in towards the later. And we hear it a lot early on. And then as he's hugging her and leaving, the music just swells up. And I remember, I think it's only about 15 minutes into the movie, and I remember seeing it for the first time thinking, like, this is something different. Like, this music with what's going on, the environment of the movie, it was just so well put together. And Zimmer's score just highlights every scene. I bought the soundtrack the day after I watched it.
I actually don't have the whole soundtrack, but I do listen to the his theme, No Time for Caution, which plays over the docking scene quite often. It's like a deceptively simple soundtrack, because very often throughout, it's just like a couple notes played over and over again, but it always perfectly fits the scene and sets the tone and like does whatever the scene needs to do, add emotional heart or tension. Yeah, it sounds simple, but it is very, very powerful in the moment. So as much as I like this film, or like elements, and I definitely respect it just as a piece of ambitious filmmaking, it's pretty unparalleled. But also, I don't know if it actually works as a film. I don't entirely understand what Nolan is trying to say. And I think it comes from, this was a script that Jonathan Nolan, his brother, wrote. And actually, for a while, Spielberg was attached. And it was more about, just about kind of interstellar space travel. And then Christopher Nolan was brought on, and he basically rewrote the script to feature the dying Earth and, I guess, the entire last act involving the climax inside the Tesseract, as they call it, which is this giant space bookshelf. And so I think you could feel it. It feels a bit like it's slightly confused about what it's trying to be about. I mean, it's also incredibly confusing from a timeline perspective. So I'm going to try to explain what I think happens in this movie. So it seems that essentially when when Cooper is inside the Tesseract, which is in the middle of a black hole for some reason, he is able to go across time and space because of his love for his daughter and peek into her bedroom, which sounds really creepy, and manipulate her bookshelf and gravity to give himself the coordinates to find NASA so he can pilot the ship to get himself out there in the first place, which is a paradox, and I hate paradoxes, and they're stupid, and they should never, ever use them because they don't work. But besides that, and it's never explained what this thing is. I mean, they say, they very, very vaguely talking about them. First, they think they're aliens. Then, for absolutely no reason ever, but Cooper says, it's us. We do this in the future. Why? I don't know. It's never explained why he comes to that conclusion. And that along with the speech from Anne Hathaway, where she talks about love being quantifiable and how we should follow our hearts, and to where then Cooper agrees, yes, love is quantifiable. It's creating this connection across space for me to talk to my daughter and give her not only the coordinates to get me out here, but also an algorithm to solve gravity. Which, what was the problem they had? There's just this really vague algorithm they have to come up with to launch a spaceship. Like, they have to solve gravity. The only way to do that is go into a black hole. Like, what? It's never explained. It doesn't make sense. And it's just, I think the film turns into this very convoluted, confusing, nonsensical mess in the end, when it didn't have to, because it's just, I don't know. I mean, what do you think about that? I'm rambling right now.
So with the bookshelf and everything that goes on in that part of the scene, I actually don't really have a whole lot of problems with. I know I'm the minority. The only part of the script that I have issues with, other than a couple lines from Anne Hathaway's character, is that scene, is Casey Affleck's character. That's the only part in this movie that, for me, feels lazy in its execution. It seemed like what Nolan decided was that, for whatever reason, he needed, as if the fact that, you know, Cooper's already pressed for time, time being the enemy is already part of one part of the story, so the idea that Jessica Chastain had to be pressed for time, to me, was unnecessary. But for whatever reason, it seemed like he wanted, like, she had to get something done fast. And instead of thinking of, like, a legitimate reason, he had to turn her brother crazy. Yeah, his motivation, I get it was the whole, you know, like, oh, I was born and raised here, I'm not going to leave. Those kind of motivations already annoy me, even if there are people out, like, who are like that out there. To me, it's really lazy writing. And so the idea that that was the reason that he wasn't going to take his sick wife out, and I don't know, I agree, that whole part of the scene really felt kind of almost written at the last second. Like, they realized that this is where the film's climax was, and they had one part of it ready, which was Cooper's, but then they needed to figure out what the heck Jessica Chastain and Casey Affleck and the other part of the cast was going to do. So, like, well, crops get lit on fire and this happens. It feels very hastily put together.
Yeah, and that leads into another issue, is the film completely breaks its own rules of time, because where it's set up that since the water planet is so close to the black hole and there's so much gravity, it speeds time up for the rest of the world if you're on it. So if he goes into a black hole, time should be racing by for the rest of the world, and yet it's happening in real time. That makes no sense. Because the film is set up that if he's this close to a black hole, time is speeding up for everybody else. But then it doesn't happen this time because plot.
Well, so the way, and I think this kind of goes back to part of the issue with the solving the problem for gravity, whatever it meant. It seemed like what they knew about the black hole was that the closer you get to it, the slower time moves for you. But what the unknown variable that it seemed that they were trying to figure out was the way the inside of a black hole behaves, because we didn't have any recorded data of what it even is on the inside. And so the way I could see them like not necessarily breaking their rule is that the way time interacts and moves on the inside of a black hole is different, because on the close to the outside, it's actually bending space and time, whereas what it does on the inside isn't necessarily clarified, which is kind of what they're trying to figure out, which is why he has to get on the inside to find the data.
But he should have still lost about a decade just flying in by the rules of the film.
I thought they had a line about that when he was just talking about Anne Hathaway at first. I may be mistaken, but I thought that they mentioned that for the time it took for them to get inside the hole, time was gonna.
Because there's like a space of time before they decide they can figure out how to get out of the black hole, because they know they're being pulled into the black hole. There's like a whole hour long, like a half hour sequence where they're trying to figure out and trying to boost themselves out of the gravitational pull, and slingshotting around it, like, which should have lost them a couple, by the rules of the film, should have lost them a couple decades just there. Which means everybody on Earth would have already been dead by the time he even had a chance to fly into the black hole. And also, how does TARS have the ability to read whatever the singularity is in order to turn it into an algorithm to send it back to Earth?
I don't know, but that's why he was sent on the mission. I think that was his purpose or part of his purpose for being there was because they were using him as the data collector.
Okay, and if future human beings transcend dimensions and decide to save their past selves, another paradox, why don't they make it easier? Because I mean, honestly, why do they have to, they put a wormhole near Jupiter and then they say you have to fly into a black hole to find us? No one's going to fly into a black hole. No one wants to fly to do that. It's very counterintuitive against to human nature.
Cooper does.
And so it only happened because Matt Damon's character went crazy for some reason, because he's lonely. But then when he finds people, he tries to kill them. Who knows why? It's just the whole ending is a bunch of conveniences and paradoxes that contradict themselves and the film's logic. It's just really frustrating. And about Dr. Mann, played by Matt Damon, why was he trying to kill them?
Well, he wasn't trying to kill them. Well, at least not for the purpose of because I want to kill these people. I actually liked his character and like the writing and what happened with that scene. To me, he was aware of what was going to, like, whenever he signed up for the mission, he understood that, you know, he may not be taken. He may not be the one that they choose. And then I think, I forget what the line is, but he even explains, like, I didn't realize what it was going to be like. He knew that their mission was to continue on to the next planet, which would give them not enough fuel, most likely, to get back to Earth. And but so what, he
was he
wanted
trying to go
to,
back to Earth?
Yes. Yeah, he was trying to get back to the spaceship so that he could fly it back to Earth.
But he was saying he was going to try to go to the next planet and save humanity. Was he lying? The entire time he's killing McConaughey, he's saying, I need to save humanity. I need to get to the next planet. So, because McConaughey wanted to go back to Earth to see his daughter before she died. So, I guess he's trying to kill McConaughey because he thinks they should try to save humanity. But if McConaughey knew that this planet was dead, he's obviously going to choose to save humanity rather than just see his daughter again.
I thought that I made a mistake. I didn't think that Damon was trying to go to the next planet. Because he told them that he lied about the amount of fuel storage they had. He told them that they had enough to get to the next planet and then back to Earth. But then he told them, he told Cooper's character, I believe, that he had lied about the amount of storage and that they don't have enough to do that. They can't do both, and that he wanted to go back to Earth because he knew he wouldn't be able to survive.
Cooper knew they only had enough fuel to get to Matt Damon's planet. That's why they were trying to make the choice when Anne Hathaway had the whole love speech about whether they should go for Wolf Edmondson's planet or Dr. Mann's planet. And they decide to get back to Earth, we only have enough fuel to go to one, so they choose that one. And then McConaughey's like, I'm going to leave you there, then I'm going to go back to Earth. But then it's revealed that, oh no, there's actually nothing here. He lied. And so the entire time Dr. Mann says, he keeps saying he's going to try to save humanity. I can't let you go back to Earth. So then, but killing you only have four people to start a whole new civilization. Seems very counterintuitive to start killing them.
Now I need to watch it again.
And also, he's a smart scientist. He knows, why does he open the airlock? I mean, come on, he knows what's going to happen.
Well, because he had been on the planet for a long time, and then, I don't know, I kind of, like, whenever they open him up and he just starts sobbing, I kind of got the feeling that this was a man who was, if not already, but most likely, like, broken, or at least at the breaking point, and he was very desperate. So, even though he is smart, I don't think it's a leap in logic to understand why he would try to talk that. Like, at that point, sheer desperation had kicked in.
Okay. If you say so. So, in spite of how much I love everything leading up to this, and even I love the sequence afterwards when they have to dock, and then as they're trying to get out of the black hole, like, just the creativity they have in finding ways to do it, I love all that. But then once they fly into the black hole and what the film is revealed to truly be about, I just think it falls on its face. So, I mean, am I right in saying this movie is about people who save themselves in the future by becoming interdimensional and using the power of love? Is that wrong to say that's what this film's about?
I think it's like there's a very like humanistic theme in the movie that we are the people who saved ourselves. Really, as much as like a lot of like leaps in logic you have to make, most of it works for me. Really, the only plot device that for me I don't get over is the love part. The idea that like love is this quantifiable thing that can like somehow lead us somewhere. Like, I even bought like the idea of the Tesseract to me is honestly one of the coolest things in the movie and like one of my favorite parts about it. The idea that like humans in the future found a way to manipulate time and space into where they can view it as a physical object and look at separate points. I thought that was all really cool. But then the explanation of how he was able to find that specific moment when he's like, it's love, Tars, it's love. Then I was like, oh, man. I was really, you know, a lot of people didn't like the fact that it went like hard sci-fi at that point.
Whereas it was fantasy.
It was all, close to that, essentially. I liked whenever he was like falling through the Tesseract, I thought that part was really cool. And I was completely into that scene, knowing full well that most people probably weren't. But then it was that line, the explanation that's how he was able to find the right moment in time was love. It felt like just almost a cop-out.
For me, for a film that has been this smart and this careful to mirror reality, for it to just dive off the deep end, not only into this incredibly unlikely realm of sci-fi fantasy or whatever that was, of five-dimensional future humans, but then just the leaps in logic, all these little leaps in logic of Tars being able to broadcast out of a black hole, or no, to brought to inside a black hole to read it and broadcast it to him, and him being able to reach through time to tell her, even though it should be about a couple decades in the future, it just breaks all of its own rules, and I don't like paradoxes. I think paradoxes are lazy because they're illogical. they don't work. If you can't cause yourself to find a place by coming back in from the future because you were never there, it doesn't work. And I don't know. It just makes me really irritated when a film tries to do that.
Time paradoxes are something weird because it's something that I acknowledge doesn't work logically, but just with paradoxes, like they don't bother me so much. I don't think they're necessarily lazy. I think it depends on whether the logic is going to bother you. Like, I mean, Inception was full of its own, like the point of paradoxes was in Inception, like the never-ending staircase. I guess if you're okay to suspend your disbelief to let that part of the movie's logic happen, then for me it's not an issue. And like I said, I actually thought that the idea that he was the person who gave himself the coordinates was a cool concept, even though it doesn't work out logically. Like, they never really talk about those kind of rules in the movie, so I don't really look at it as breaking its own rule.
I was talking breaking its own rules about gravity and time. I mean, well, it just breaks the rules of logic and coherence.
So most of what's going on with everything with the time and relativity and the Tesseract, apart from the love portion of that, I really don't have a whole lot of issues with that part of the movie. Like, whenever I say I have issues with the ending, it's actually things that most other people don't usually think about whenever they're talking about the ending. The biggest, or at least, maybe not the biggest, but one of my biggest complaints is the conclusion of, like, the father-daughter part of the relationship. It was very anticlimactic and unsatisfying. Because,
bye,
like,
bye.
Yeah, like, just to talk about Mackenzie Foy again, she is so good in this movie. Like, I feel like good child actors are a hard thing to come by. And so she was carrying such, like, even though she's not in, like, the second two acts, she's carrying, like, the emotional weight of the movie even after she's not in it, just because, like, she's the motivation. And then Jessica Chastain continues it, and she's such a phenomenal actress, especially with her video recordings. She continues the idea that, you know, this is still what they're after. This is still the end goal. These are the people he's trying to protect. And so when he comes back and he just sees her and he's like, oh, you know, I did this for you. He's like, oh, go live your life. But I'm like, I appreciate that you want me to live my life, but golly, like, we had like a 2-minute conversation. So it's really unsatisfying. And she's, you know, she's kind of saying, like, this is my family right now. Like, you know, these people didn't know him. And it's like, okay, well then, if I were the people in the hospital room and I saw him, I would want to get to know him, not be like, you know, I wasn't able to be involved with my extended family, so I shall not at all. Like, it just, the entire conclusion with the family portion of it, I felt really just was unsatisfying.
Oh yeah, another problem with time. Why is she old but Anne Hathaway is still young?
Because Anne Hathaway was on the outside of the black hole.
But no, but Jessica Chastain was still young while he was in the black hole and able to build the whole spaceship.
But Anne Hathaway was, no, she was, I think that's partly of what you were talking about, where those Jessica Chastain becoming old, that was the result of them being that close to the black hole for that long. Because prior to that, she was Jessica Chastain, and so...
But Anne Hathaway gets out.
She gets out, but not after having already been there for long enough to cause Jessica Chastain's character to grow old.
But the Tesseract collapses instantly after he gives Jessica Chastain the coordinates, and then it spits him out who knows where. Shouldn't... I don't know, this doesn't make any sense. Whatever. I'm done. All right. Do you have any other criticisms you have?
One last one. I really, really like and dislike the ending overall. It's essentially like a 20-minute conclusion. Like, when he comes back and he sees her, and then he's on like the round satellite with the, you know, the farms back, and he's going through all the historical homes. I love all of that. I like it when movies actually take time to provide a conclusion and to show the consequences of what you had just seen. I really dislike it whenever the finale happens and then the movie is like, oh, we did it, and then it ends. It's like, make it worth it. Like, now that he's essentially won and he's done what he needed to do, I want to see what society looks like. So I loved all of that. But then whenever he talks to her and she says, go, Brand is waiting for you, it ends. I'm like, okay, well, I need to see the payoff to their relationship now. And you don't see it. So it's like, it's weird because it's essentially a 20-minute ending, and yet it still feels very abrupt to me. Because we're going well and we're seeing explanations and we're seeing the outcome of essentially all of the events that happen in the movie, and then it ends. Like, they're like, oh, here's this other character. This is another major character. What happened to her? Oh, she's on Mars. End. It just, there was another way, just another conclusion to an important character arc and character relationship that fell flat for me.
All right, so what are your final thoughts about this film?
Even though I do have issues with the ending, they aren't so much with the paradoxes and with the logic that the movie makes. It's more of just with the... It's a very character-driven film with all the sci-fi and the grand scale that's going on and the epicness of the scope. These characters are at the heart of it. And so for the movie to just kind of get to the end and then say, oh, and this is what happened to these people, and then just end, that's my biggest complaint with it. But even with that aside, like, everything else about this movie, the scale, the visuals, the music, the characters, the writing, the tone and the setting, it's so... I mean, I know part of it reminds me of 2001 A Space Odyssey, but that's actually a movie I'm not a big fan of, which I don't think I'm supposed to say as, like, a movie buff, but I just... It's just very slow. But, like, just in terms of its tone and its setting, it reminds me of that a little bit. But not enough for me to say that this movie isn't, like, distinctly its own thing. Everything about this movie almost is unique to it in the way that it presents itself. And it does enough well to where I can't help but still love it. What about you?
For me, I think this is without doubt like a brilliant work from an incredible artist. I think there are some of the most compelling and awe-astounding cinematic visuals I've ever seen in here. I like the characters. I think it's a completely gripping and engaging story for the most of the film. My problems with it basically come down to the conclusion, and basically when it comes around time for the film to tell you what it's about, I think it's just a very bad, confusing cop-out, in a way. I don't think it makes sense. I don't think I don't find it that interesting. I find it just pretty stupid, to be honest. So, it is my least favorite Nolan film. I definitely enjoyed the experience of watching it. I think everybody should watch it because it is such an incredible piece of art. But I don't know that it's a great film, and it's frustrating despite all the good things about it. And so, yeah, definitely watch it, and I intend to watch it again in the future just because I want to see some of the stuff Nolan did here. But as a whole, like as a cohesive whole, a story, I personally don't think it works. So I'm kind of mixed on it. I think it's definitely incredible. Zimmer's score is astounding. Acting's great, but it does frustrate me quite a bit in certain ways. So yeah, it's I guess a bit of a disagreement between us.
The thing with this movie is, it's one of those ones that I love. But I still get the criticisms. I get why this conclusion is disappointing to a lot of people. To me, just as a whole, when you weigh like the pros about it and the ambition, I still, like I said, I still can't help but like it. And then for me, apart from his very first directorial debut with The Following, The Dark Knight Rises is without a doubt his worst. But
I like The Dark Knight Rises.
I like it too, which is I think just a testament to Nolan. But overall, this is actually, I would put this in his upper half, if not just because what it gets right, and when it gets it right, it puts itself above almost any other movie.
Yeah, I wouldn't disagree there. All right, well, I think we've said about all we can say about that movie. Next week, we're going to be doing something a little different. For our 10th episode, we're going to go through our 10 favorite films of all time. And this is proving pretty difficult for me. I have a number one that I've had for the last decade, but all the others are in a constant state of flux, so this should be really fun.
It's been tough to deliberate. I think I've got my top five about fixed, top five or six maybe. And then when I get to the last half, it really hurts cutting some of these movies.
Yeah, there's like at least 20 that I want to get on there.
There's like 20 that I feel deserve it. Like, I feel like I'm cheating the director out of a spot on my list by not including it.
Yeah, I'm really looking forward to this one. And I hope to be doing a mini-sode pretty soon on The Magnificent Seven. I actually saw it like for a second time last night, and I really, really enjoy it. I want to talk about that.
I look forward to listening to that one. Although I guess I probably better see the movie beforehand.
Yeah, it's a good movie. All right. Well, if you enjoyed this podcast, again, if you could rate and review us on iTunes and subscribe, that would really help us out. And if you want to get in touch with us, we're on Facebook as Underrated Podcast. That's where we do most of our interaction with our listeners. And we also have a website, underratedpodcast.com.
And then if you want to contact us by way of email, we are theunderratedpodcast@gmail.com. And then we are also on Twitter. You can follow us at @_pod.
And also I'm on Facebook as Gabriel Green, if you'd like to shoot me a friend request.
Yeah, and I'm James Hamrick, and the same goes for me. If you want to message me or talk about movies, I'm more than up for it.
Yeah, well, that was fun. I really enjoyed watching this movie again, even though I'm still disappointed by it. Yeah, and I'm definitely looking forward to coming back next week. It's going to be a challenge to create a list, but it'll be fun talking about it.
Yeah, it's hard. I think I really like the episodes where we disagree. It gives us more to talk about. It's less of just one saying something and affirming it, having it affirmed by the other. But
yeah,
I think it's fun. And yeah, I definitely look forward to next week's episode. So until then, we will see y'all later.
See ya.